Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is Daniel Rowland, who's back on the show after our first research roundup together back in episode 698. And in today's episode, we're back with edition two, for the two of us anyway, and we're going to each bring up a couple of recent studies that we've found interesting and get into what these studies have done and found, and most importantly, how to apply this in practice, if you can do that at all. Daniel, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Doing very well, Michael. Thank you very much for having me. As I was talking with you before the show, I've been doing some hiking in the mountains here in Switzerland, and that's been a very enjoyable way to spend the summer. But looking forward to getting into some studies today.
Yes, let's get right to it. And I can start us off today. So my first study is called Maximal Glycolytic Flux Modulates Metabolic Thresholds Independent of Maximal Oxygen Uptake. But what they did in this study is that they essentially investigated whether VLA-max, which is the glycolytic flux that they talk about, whether that can modulate an athlete's threshold when you control for VO2-max. For listeners that have been with us for a long time, you've probably heard quite a few episodes that talk about the concept of VLA-max, but for newer listeners, just as a very quick summary, the idea here, which is based on work by Alois Mader initially and then some of his colleagues, is that you have your aerobic engine, which is VO2max, and you have your anaerobic engine or your glycolytic engine, more specifically, which is your VLA-max, so your maximal glycolytic rate. And these two kind of work in conjunction is the wrong word. They're almost like they are antagonists to each other. So a higher VO2max results in a higher threshold, but a higher VLA max results in a lower threshold because you're in, well, there, this is where we step into the area of theory rather than proven results. But the theory is that you're using more fastish fibers, you're more glycolytic, and you're less able to hold a steady power output or a steady pace for a longer time when your VLA max is higher, likely because you're tapping into those more glycolytic fibers earlier compared to somebody who has a lower VLA-max to start with. So then the extension of that in theory is that if you lower your VLA-max, you can increase your threshold without touching your VO2-max. You could even potentially, by lowering your VLA-max quite a lot, even if your VO2-max also decreases a little, you could still get a net improvement in your threshold. Yeah, for listeners on the podcast, if that was hard to understand, I was doing some hand gestures, so you can go to the YouTube video and that might become more clear. And I'll put links to these studies and some past episodes in the show notes, of course, so you can listen to that because that would be a good starting point. Anyway, this study I chose because I found that it was super fascinating. It's the first one that has basically empirically proven one of the points of this theory laid out by Mader, which is that yes, it seems indeed like if your VLA max is higher for a fixed VO2 max, then your threshold is lower and vice versa. So they took 50 trained cyclists, of which 20 were women. So that's actually a very good ratio. And they did a laboratory-based VLA max test where they did a 15-second sprint, all-out sprint seated on the bike on an ergometer, but on the athlete's own bikes. And they calculated VLA max by measuring lactate, obviously baseline lactate before starting the sprint, but also every minute for 9 minutes, and to make sure that they captured the highest lactate that was accumulated. And then you can calculate the lactate accumulation rate, or lactate building rate, VLA max, or VLA peak, they call it in this study, because it's not the true max, it's the peak that is measured. And they also measured VO2 max, ventilatory thresholds, and a bunch of other things. But the long and short of the story is that fact that with a higher VLA max, when you controlled for VO2 max, then threshold was lower, and vice versa. With a lower VLA max, when you controlled for VO2 max, then threshold was higher. And they additionally built some regression models to see how much of your threshold is explained by a few variables. So in their base model, they only used VO2 max and sex, so male or female. And then they tried to see how much does this model improve if you add VLA max or VLA peak. And they found that it actually improved quite a bit. They had a lot of threshold measures, but up to, well, R-square improved by quite substantial amounts. I think from memory, I might be wrong on this, but I think it was 10 to 20% for certain thresholds that the accuracy of the model improved or of the regression analysis improved by adding VLA peak. But what's interesting as well is that if you just added the sprint power or even the sprint power relative to lean body mass, none of those actually improved the model almost at all. There were very small improvements with sprint power relative to lean body mass, but extremely small. And it really seems that it was actually the VLA max or VLA peak that helped build a more accurate model and explain threshold much more rather than the pure sprinting power, which makes sense when you think about that in a 15-second sprint, quite a lot of it can be explained by the creatine phosphate system, which is not glycolytic. So you actually want to look into the lactate dynamics to be able to assess the glycolytic contribution of that sprint rather than the creatine phosphate contribution. My thinking has always been that, well, in theory, if that is the case, why don't you do like a 30-second to 1-minute test for VLA max? Would that be more accurate? In the discussion of this study, there was quite some interesting points about that, and it seems that that's generally not the consensus. The consensus is that either you do 15 seconds or you do something slightly shorter, 10 to 12 seconds. I haven't looked deeply into that to be able to explain clearly why. But that's basically... So if that is the case, then the interesting thing here is that, yes, printing power in itself is not something that necessarily helps you assess whether your threshold is going to be higher or lower based on VO2 max, but the actual VLA max is. So yeah, that's it. This is what the study did and what they found. I'll let you jump in here, Daniel, before we discuss some applications and the directions.
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting study as well. I did note that that it's a correlational finding, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean that a beta glycolytical engine causes lower thresholds. So maybe that's a space where there's further testing and further things to investigate for researchers. I think it's quite interesting as well that they found no link between VLA max and fat oxidation. And I would have expected there to be some sort of link there as well, because of this substrate utilization would be differing between different types of athletes. So I think it's a very useful study to start giving us some insights and to start building up knowledge on how to use this and how to think about it as a metric.
Yeah. This study of the four that we have, I think, is probably the least practical, because I'm not sure that we're going to give much in terms of practical evidence. But I know a lot of listeners are familiar with VLA max and have been also following the debate that has been going around it. Maybe it's been a bit quiet in the last few years, but certainly a few years ago, there was quite some debates around it all over the place, it seems like. And the reason for that is that it has for a long time been a very theoretical concept that has been explained and described by Mader and other colleagues, but mainly in theory and in single cell studies rather than in actual real athletes like this one. And while that has its advantages, it definitely also has its disadvantages, and you need to see that something actually happens in the organism, which is a complex system, rather than in a single cell or in a theoretical model of cellular physiology. So this is a good step, but yeah, you're absolutely right to point out that it's correlational and it doesn't prove causation. And that was one of my main point that I written down as what do I want to see next now that that this study has been done, would be a training intervention study where you try to basically lower the VLA max, for example. It could be increase by any means, but I think the more for endurance athletes, the more typical scenario would be that you have a medium to medium high VLA max and you try to lower it to improve your threshold. I would want to see that as a training intervention study. If you manage to do that, well, you could do that as two studies, really. The first study would be, well, what are the training interventions that can actually do that? The second study would be, if you do that, given that you managed to decrease your VLA max, did your threshold increase proportionally if the VO2 max didn't change. And I guess you can control for VO2 max changes if they do happen statistically. So that wouldn't be too big a deal. But yeah, that's what I would like to see, that whether this correlation that exists in a snapshot in time, whether it also holds true when you longitudinally, when you actually make training interventions targeting VLA max.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I think the time course of adaptation would be interesting to see. So I think that you were talking before the podcast about muscle type perhaps being something that could show us some sort of similar profiling of athletes. And that's not that quick or easy to change. And is it possible to change VLA max relatively quickly over the course of a season, or is it multiple seasons, or what does that need to look like? I think that would be an interesting next step as well, to try and understand just how changeable it is as a metric.
Yeah, I think just what I've heard anecdotally from like Sebastian Weber, for example, who was the first person certainly to commercialize it, but also the first person to really bring it to the mainstream of both athletes, but also coaches' attention, I would say, outside of maybe a subset of coaches in Germany and the Benelux countries. But he, I think from memory, would said that in six to eight weeks, you can do some changes. Although, and those would be more the functional changes, but then there are also structural changes that would take longer. But you could see some changes in 6 to 8 weeks, which would definitely be necessary for it to be feasible to do at least a pilot level intervention, training intervention study, because probably nobody's going to touch a potential study that takes a year of training to maybe not even see a result. So yeah, I think there's scope for that. I've definitely seen that, if not by measuring VLA max directly in such short time increments and not measuring it with lactate but with modeling, but I've seen similar changes with modeling with software that estimate it, and then you can argue how accurate that is compared to actually doing it based on lactate. On the other hand, there are also disadvantages with lactate, which I talked about on this podcast, that it's quite there's quite a high coefficient of variability for lactate. But when you do, I think that when you do like a sort of 9 samples, then you really reduce a lot of that potential error compared to doing lactate guided training. So I actually do believe that this protocol of doing this all out sprint, taking a sample every minute and seeing what the maximum value is, that is, in my opinion, anecdotally, a valid experiment. I've actually seen it done live. I haven't done it, but Dan Lorang came to Lisbon to hold a seminar for triathlon coaches here in Portugal. And this was quite some time ago, probably in 2018 or so. And he did this with a volunteer from the audience who stepped up on the indoor bike trainer, did an all out sprint, and then took lactate samples every minute, plotted them out on a whiteboard. And I can't remember exactly, but I do remember that it was quite far into that, maybe 7 minutes into that. So 7 minutes post sprint that the maximum lactate value was reached. So you get a nice parabolic shape on that lactate curve. That the point there being that if you want to do this as a lactate test, that's really important. I think that maybe you could get away with doing it every 90 seconds or even every 2 minutes, but you want to extend it to make sure that you capture the maximum lactate, and also keep in mind that the longer the interval between your samples you take, the larger the chance that you're going to miss the maximum. But that doesn't mean that you miss it by too much, I should also say. Like, yeah, it might go down a little bit if you miss the peak, but is that too relevant in the grand scheme of things? I would say maybe not.
I think that's interesting. I think the question that I was asking myself just about the concept of VLA max is how much it would change an athlete's training. And I feel like naturally, I wouldn't necessarily give an Ironman athlete the kinds of sessions that would promote VLA max anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe it's a refinement of training principles for some athletes, and it wouldn't necessarily change training for all athletes. I don't know if that's a fair take, Michael. What do you think with your experience?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty fair take, because I have definitely gone through periods when I was using it quite a bit more. And then I found that, well, actually, and I think that that period really helped to refine my coaching a bit, but I don't use it directly, haven't used it directly in quite a long time. But I think there are definitely concepts that I've taken from that. And the way I sort of profile athletes and view athletes now, I would say is more based on fiber typology. And so it's more, yeah, I would say you could call it more subjective and qualitative rather than anything. It's definitely, there's nothing quantitative about it. So it's absolutely qualitative. But some of the concepts for training, I would still use, absolutely. And like you say, for an Ironman athlete, at least when you talk about a specific training, then yeah, you wouldn't do that type of training at all. So, but then, I guess it's a bit different when you talk about the general training. So for example, one thing that I found is that athletes who have a very low VLA max, they struggle to benefit from high intensity interval training that targeting VO2 max. So sometimes I found it helpful to build VLA max first before targeting VO2 max because that gives them a bit more of a buffer to be able to do the sessions that are required to increase VO2 max on the intensity side. Of course, you always have to have the volume side as well, but that's an example where it could be useful. But I mean, I think your point is absolutely right. I wouldn't recommend athletes start taking doing a sprint and taking 9 lactate samples, but I think it's more the principle that if you can't really necessarily 100% trust your feel that you're very glycolytic or not, because at least when it comes to sprinting, like we talked about, it could be creatine phosphate system that you're using to create a high power sprint. And but you can have a bit of a you can definitely have an idea of where you stand, at least based comparing the extremes. You probably know that you're not very low glycolytic or you're not very high glycolytic, and you might be somewhere in between. But anyway, you can have a feel of that, and you can potentially think about your training and your physiology in a way that, is this something I should consider? And maybe even do what ifs, like what if the reason that I haven't been responding to my training is that I'm actually doing training that is maybe not ideally suited to me because I might be a bit more glycolytic than I thought, or vice versa even. So I think that's it's more the principles and giving some food for thought for the listeners here, and whether this could have implications for training rather than any direct prescriptions.
Yeah, I like that. And I think we often talk about the research being a few steps behind coaches. And this is a case where there's some research now coming to back up some concepts. And more than just verifying what those coaches were saying, there's an explanatory power to having the research and seeing how it's controlled in a lab that helps other people understand it a little bit better. So it's a nice study to bring some more light on that concept.
This episode is brought to you by Precision Fuel Hydration. One of the best tools that they offer is the free Fuel Hydration Planner that builds you a personalized strategy for any race, from triathlons of various distances to running, cycling, and swim run events. They also have most of the Ironman and Ironman 73 races globally pre-built into the planner as the partner of Ironman globally. And their fuel options in terms of products range from PF30 gels to PF90 with 30 and 90 grams of carbs respectively. They have a caffeinated version of the PF30 for an extra boost pre-race or mid-race. And if you're used to mixing gels into a concentrated carb bottle on the bike, like I used to do, then their Flow Gel is a brilliant alternative, which basically passes that strategy into the history books. The Flow Gel contains 300 grams of carbs. They also have drink mixes and a range of electrolyte products that you can match to your sweat sodium concentration. Check out all of this and the resources on precisionfuelhydration.com, and you'll learn to use a great balance of science and practice in your race nutrition hydration. And use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off your first order.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to your first one.
Yeah. Today, the first study that I want to talk about is called How Much Running is Too Much? And the idea behind the study was looking at whether a certain metric can prove a higher likelihood of injury in runners. So this study comes from July 2025, and it is a cohort study, and it was looking at 18 months of training data from Garmin devices for 5,200 runners. So I think this is kind of interesting when we're looking at actual data from athletes rather than just a normal sort of study design. And what they did was split the kinds of exposures into three exposures which they thought might be indicative of injury risk. The first was comparing one individual run, the longest run, against the athlete's longest run in the last 30 days. The second one was comparing a one-week relative running load to the previous 3 weeks. And then they were also looking at a one-week, using a week-to-week ratio. And that would be sort of testing that idea of you shouldn't increase your running load more than 10% per week, which is something I think that we've all used before and heard of. And the results showed that it was particularly the first metric, the individual run compared to the longest run of the last 30 days, that had a correlation between injury risk, a self-reported injury risk from the runners, and the increase in the longest run compared to the longest run in the last 30 days. So for a run that was 10 to 30% greater than the longest run in the last 30 days, athletes had a 64% higher chance of injury. For runs that were 30% to 100% greater than the longest run in the last 30 days, the increase in injury risk was 52%. And then when athletes did more than 100%, which is a kind of crazy metric, because some people were doing more than double their longest run in the last 32 days, their results showed that they had 128% increase in self-reported injuries. So the risk here is very high. I think what is interesting...
Yeah, sorry, Daniel, just one point there. When you say self-reported injury risk, it's the injuries that are self-reported, and then the risk is calculated, right? So it's not that the athletes here are guessing their injury risk, but that's measured. But you still have to accept the fact that there might be some, you might miss some data, some incomplete data when athletes self-report their injuries, rather than going into a sports medicine doctor or a lab of some kind to test for injuries. That's just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and a good clarification. Sorry for the confusion with what I was saying there. But what I thought was really interesting is that it was particularly that metric, the longest run in the last 30 days, is something that you want to be checking against. Because usually we try and use acute to chronic ratios for training. And it seems that perhaps there can be something hidden in the data there that for these runners in particular didn't show up with their relation to injury risk. So it might be that they did these extra long runs and then they shortened some of the other runs in the week, and that is sort of hiding and not showing up in a lot of the metrics that we might use as athletes and coaches, that we can look on Training Peaks dashboards and things like that. I think... lots of runners are also not necessarily looking at their long run in that way. They're just thinking about the demands of the race, and perhaps if the race is getting closer, they make big jumps to try and match what's coming up in the race. But that can obviously bring quite a lot of risk with it, which is what this showed. I think that it's also important to note with the style of study that it's observational data, so it shows an association. It's not necessarily proof that that's exactly the cause of those running injuries. There might have been other things going on in the background. But I think it's a useful data point for athletes is to look at their last long run, or the longest run in the last 30 days, and to plan newer runs, long runs, that keep within 10% of that total distance.
Let me ask you then, as a coach, which one, if you had to choose one, you increase an athlete's long run by 15 or 20% more than their longest run from the last 30 days, but you keep the overall volume of the week maybe within 5% of the previous week, or even the same as the previous week, or you had to do it the other way around, you increase the total weekly volume by the same 15 to 20% compared to the biggest week or the last 3 weeks, but the long run stays very much within, very similar to the longest previous one. Which one would you prefer to do to minimize the risk of injury anecdotally from your experience?
I think I would also be careful with the longest long run, actually. I think what this study found, I think maybe perhaps because of the nature of running injuries, that they can be bone stress or tendon and muscular kind of injuries that happen, that there's a bigger risk from a large exposure to impact and that long duration of the long run. I think from what I've seen, I'm just trying to think of my athletes who've been injured, has been after occasions like that, whereas I think smaller doses are easier to cope with. So I think that would be probably what I would go with is what the finding of the study is.
Yeah, I would be the same, absolutely. And I think that that's something, I think probably a practical takeaway for listeners, what I would do, especially if it's a runner or a triathlete that has had injuries in the past, if you're preparing for a marathon or an Ironman and you have a longest workout in mind, a longest run in mind that you want to do, maybe it's 34 kilometers of running 3 or 4 weeks out from your goal marathon, then that's not something that you can start to think about 6-7 weeks before you're there, or you have to think about this well in advance and build up your progression. I think that's when you map out the training progression for, that is where running plays a big part. So whether it's for a marathon or for an Ironman, where you do still have that, you need to do, probably most people need to do a certain amount of long running there, then mapping out that progression so that you can reduce the step size or the step length or step size, I should say, basically increases in distance from run to run or increase in duration. And that's what I would consider the most important, more important compared to anything else, really, whether we're talking about what sessions should you be doing or what's your total volume be. That's how I approach it generally. For these longer races, I would be less, that would be probably not quite as high up in the hierarchy for races or for runners who don't really do really long runs. If the longest you do is maybe 15, 16 kilometers, then I would be less concerned probably, even if the increase is a bit bigger. But when you get close to 20 kilometers or certainly above the half marathon, that's when I would take that really seriously, basically.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the one point I made was saying that sometimes the risk of injury for runners can get hidden when you have some of the shorter other runs in the week, so the total week doesn't look that good. But that's not to imply that you should keep the total of the week very high, even when you are increasing the long run. I think that we know that you need to be careful with around those long runs in total as well. So allowing adequate time for recovery after that, I think, is important, and making sure that the total running load is also managed. It's not irrelevant, but it's maybe a secondary metric to managing this longest long run that you do.
Yeah. I think another point that I wanted to highlight as well for listeners is that, so of the things that they investigated here, so the long run itself versus the acute chronic workload ratio on a 1 week, 1-to-1 week and 1-to-3 weeks, right? Those were the time windows that they used. So that's similar, but not the same as what, for example, Training Peaks use with their training stress balance, which is based on 1 week compared to 28 days. But those 28 days includes the 1 week. So 1 week to 4 weeks, including the 1 week. But that's also, it's not a ratio, it's a differential. Still very similar concepts. You're trying to compare what you did in the last 7 days, so acutely, compared to what you did over a slightly longer period going back. And I would think that they usually track pretty well with each other, and there's not a huge difference there. But that's important I would say to understand that, well, the acute chronic workload ratio wasn't the thing that best explained the rate of running injuries, right? So this is something that I've been saying for many years, that I'm not that big of a believer in the utility of the performance management chart and the training stress balance and all of those metrics. I just don't see it as that important for anything. But this is definitely one of the areas where I would least trust it when it comes to trying to control your running load by using a metric such as training stress balance, because I think that you can just fool yourself a bit by, you know, averaging out the large spikes of kind of dangerous stimulus or injury provoking stimulus that you might have, whether that be volume or intensity.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that's what's interesting here, is that is maybe a caution on relying too much on those kind of charts and metrics. And also a caution to be careful about the old school rule of don't increase your total running mileage by more than 10%, which didn't have that strong a correlation with running injuries either. So it's really one sort of maybe newer metric because not everyone uses it. And maybe if you do use it, you've been using it sort of not intentionally, but just as a gut feel for not increasing your long runs too much. But maybe this is something that we could keep in our training logs and measure and make sure that we don't go too wild with those long runs. Don't get pressured into group runs that are too long for you that put too much on top of your previous longest run in the last 30 days.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this, my final point on this study, I think, is that within my Training Peaks dashboard, probably the chart that I look at the most is the chart that shows longest run by week. So it's a bar chart. Every week it shows that, okay, this week it was 20 kilometers, then next week 22, 18, 22, 20, 24, etc. And obviously I can choose then the time frame that I'm looking at, whether it's the last 90 days or last 180 days, but it makes it super easy to just a quick glance and hover over the bars to see, okay, what was the actual distance that we have been doing in the last weeks? And you can see that you're then progressing the run volume appropriately. But yeah, I would say that that is probably the most used chart that I have on my Training Peaks dashboard. And, yeah. And anybody that has not just Training Peaks, but probably pretty much any training software lets you set up that kind of chart as well. And yeah, I would recommend doing that.
Yeah, I think it's a good reminder to people to look at it. That's the key is here's something that is shown to increase injury risk. So make sure that you're looking at it.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to my second study, which I already teased the name of before. This one is called Dose Response to Endurance Training, Training Load and Biomarkers in Elite Triathletes. And it was published, it is by Sehuela and colleagues and published in this year. I didn't write down the month, but very, very recently it came up. Basically, this is a Spanish group of athletes and very high-level athletes. Many of them have, some of them, they mentioned the number, have been on podiums in the highest level of triathlon races, the World Triathlon Championship Series. And they have some, they're all coached by the same coaches in the same training group. And then some of those coaches and collaborating with researchers, they also do academic research and but very ecologically valid research by just taking the data of these athletes when they're training. So it makes it, I would say that already off the bat, that the limitation of a study like this is that it's not very well controlled at all because there's no control group. But also things are a little bit, you have to do things based on the optimization is done for the athlete's performance, not for the research to be well controlled or get all the data points when you really need them and so on. So that's certainly a limitation, but it's also at the same time a bit of a strength because it's ecologically valid. It's in the field, which sometimes is a problem with very controlled studies that you might get a result in the lab that then doesn't translate to the field and actual practice. So this study, I will probably spend a lot less time on than the previous one. They did measure a bunch of things, and one of the main premises was they wanted to repeatedly, every few weeks, they took a blood test to measure urea and creatine kinase. Urea being a marker of metabolic load in a way, or used as such anyway. It's basically a marker of protein turnover from the urine. Not from the urine, mixed it up with urea from the blood. And the creatine kinase being more a marker of muscular damage rather than metabolic load. And those two markers, they tried to then correlate with the training load that the athletes were doing in different periods and see if there was a correlation there. What was interesting was that they didn't only measure training load objectively, they also had subjective measures that they quantified, and they measured the ratio of objective to subjective training load. So there were quite a few interesting analyses that they did there with different correlations. And they used performance testing only on the bike, unfortunately, but still it was something. So they did that, a bike test that measured VO2 max and VT1, VT2 ventilatory thresholds. And they also tried to correlate that with the blood markers that they measured and also with the training load. And training load ratio, subjective to objective. So a couple of key takeaways there were that urea actually correlated well with training load, with objective training load, whereas creatine kinase didn't do it much at all, if at all. Creatine kinase was high when you started a training period after a time off, but then it went up because basically the body isn't at all adapted. But then it seems like it quickly goes down and flatlines, and then it doesn't change whether it's a heavy training period or a medium or low load training period. But urea was tracking much better with the actual training load. And it also tracked with gains in VO2 max and power at the second ventilatory threshold. So basically, if you had a bigger rise in urea, then you saw smaller gains in those metrics. And so basically smaller performance improvements, or at least markers of performance improvements, which the researchers basically described with a bit of a dose response model that, yeah, the athletes that had their urea compared to their baseline get a bit too high, they just didn't see the response in training. And the final thing that they did was that they measured correlated the ratio of objective to subjective training load and how that correlated with the blood markers and performance improvements. And they did find that the athletes that had a higher objective to subjective ratio, meaning they did more work for the same effort, or they did the same work for lower effort, they had a smaller increase in urea. And again, let's remember, urea was correlated to performance improvements. Lower urea was correlated to bigger performance improvements. But you can't make the jump there, that one leads to the other, and the one leads to one, and the second leads to a third thing, and then the first one must lead to the third thing. They didn't show that in the study. But these were basically a bunch of small findings that I think are not at all dramatic or change the way that we should view training. But I think that they, in some ways, confirm a bit in the field some things that we already know and we should remind ourselves of, that training is a dose response model. And these athletes were all training hard and they were training a lot. But there is still a dose response model there, that there is a level where both markers of stress increase quite a lot, and the markers of stress that were correlated with performance improvements. There's a lot more work and a lot more controlled work that could be done and needs to be done to be able to build a proper dose response model there. But I think that I haven't seen too many studies like this, if any, especially in elite triathletes of the level that these were. So I just found it fascinating. I wouldn't say that the conclusion is that you should go out and do blood tests every few weeks or every couple of months. And that was also not what the authors argued either. What they did say is that a blood test in itself, using the reference ranges for urea or creatine kinase, means very, very little. But it's when you measure it longitudinally. So this study was actually going on for 4 whole years. So it was a 4-year study, even though some athletes dropped in and out. So many athletes were only there for 1 or 2, maybe 3 seasons, not 4 seasons. But they accumulated data over 4 years. And a few athletes were in the study for that whole period of 4 years. Either way, the point there being, I think my main takeaway as a coach is something that I already practice quite a lot, which is to try to assess what is the athlete's subjective workload for the objective work that they're doing. And that's what an athlete does when they're putting the RPE for a session into Training Peaks. And then you as a coach see that, okay, they did this, they had this RPE for whatever they did for that session. But when I look at what they've been doing the last few weeks, it looks like they're actually doing a lot less power, but the RPE is higher. And that's a signal for a coach. Not maybe or definitely not for me when it happens just one time. That's just something to check in next day, see how next day goes, and hopefully next day is better. If it happens 2 days, be a bit on the lookout. If it happens 3 days, that's a warning flag. That's when I sort of want to investigate further immediately and see what's going on. So I think that this study basically reinforced that value of trying to, in whatever way you do it, trying to assess the subjective to objective workload.
Yeah, I thought that was my same conclusion. I think that whenever we look at metrics to try to assess load and understand the implication it has on the body, that we very seldom see that there's one individual metric that has a great explanatory power. It's always that combination of different subjective and objective scores in relation to each other that is the important thing. I thought something that you said as well, Michael, about creating your own baseline, but the authors did mention that there was substantial inter-individual variability observed, particularly in the urea measurements. So I think that's the idea, if you are going to start chasing a metric like that, is that you need to build a baseline and understand how it applies to you. It's not a simple plug and play that you can just take a new metric and check with your normal doctor what your blood urea level is and make an assessment of your training quality. It's something that you need to do over time. And for me, the other interesting takeaway was just that there was no relation with creatine kinase and training load. I would have thought, maybe from my experience with trail runners in particular, that idea of creatine kinase being a marker of muscle damage and perhaps inability to adapt to the training would have been more important, because there's a lot of eccentric load in running, and perhaps that's, in my mind, would have been a big impact on creatine kinase level, and that would be an interesting metric that could be used. So I think that's an interesting takeaway here, is that that's not necessarily something that we need to be looking at as well.
Yeah, that was one of my takeaways as well. And also because a lot of studies do measure creatine kinase as an outcome metric for example, comparing different training as, let's say, harder or easier on the body. And maybe, at least with elite triathletes here, that maybe it's not that sensitive to say that creatine kinase is a good outcome metric to compare studies or compare training interventions in that way. So yeah, I agree with that one.
Yeah, that was the key thing for me. I think the body is complex, and listening to subjective scores is always important.
Yeah, I think a couple of other things that we could mention here, sort of directions for future research, is that this one had all male triathletes, so that was a limitation. Also, they're all using the same, they all did the same training and had the same training group and coach. So how that then extends to other types of training, other training philosophies or training groups, that's something that we don't really know. And of course, we would like to see testing not just on the bike, but swimming and running, and maybe also using something like cortisol or cortisol to testosterone ratio could be of additional value to as a marker to for on the biomarker side of things.
Yeah, agree with all of those things. And at the same time, like you said at the beginning of the study, just having an insight into elite triathletes is fascinating. So yeah. And I'm grateful for that insight from these study authors.
This group, they publish quite a lot. Obviously, I'll put all the studies in the show notes, links to them and their open access. So if listeners are interested, you can go and look them up. They have, for example, I think 2 years of training from Fernando Alarza, who I can't remember what he finished, but he's a two-time Olympian, I believe, and was back around 2019, 2018, around that time frame, he was one of the strongest on the short distance scene. So definitely somebody whose case study is interesting to look at. And it was also interesting because they do, even in this study, they showed their periodization model, and it was very traditional periodization that they did. So just a fun tidbit of information there from how they coach. But they have lots of these in the field studies with elite triathletes and yeah, they're quite interesting. So a good group to follow.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right, let's do your second study then.
Yes, the study is called Less Time, Same Gains, and a very catchy title, but it's comparing a strength training, a superset, versus traditional set training on muscular adaptation. So the participants in the study, there were 43 participants, both male and female, and they were trained in strength participants, so they weren't beginners. They were split into different groups. One was the superset group, where they would combine two exercises. So for example, in the gym, if you're doing one lower body exercise like squats, you combine that with an upper body exercise like bicep curls, and instead of breaking it up and having a long period between them, as soon as you finished your squats, you do your bicep curls. So you're combining these two different exercises together to create a superset. And they compared these superset training style to a traditional training style where you just do one exercise and then you move on to the next one. So the study was conducted over 8 weeks, and there were two strength sessions per week. And what the authors found was that there was the same outcome. So in terms of muscular strength, hypertrophy, body composition, and local muscular endurance, there was the same adaptation to the strength training, whether the athletes did superset training or traditional training. Why this is valuable is because with the six exercises that they chose and the superset structure that they chose, the athletes were able to get the same gains, but they used 36% less time for their training. I think this is kind of interesting because for triathletes, we often try not to do strength training, or we skip it because of time limitations. And this is showing a way that you can optimize your strength training by combining exercises and reducing the total period for the strength session, but also getting the same gains.
Yeah, and 36% less time, to put that in actual minutes, was 69 for the traditional group and 44 for the superset group. So 25 minutes per session, twice per week, almost an hour that the athletes saved per week. So that's not nothing to sneeze at. I think this is a very, very good practical study, and it does make sense. What would be interesting to know next is how far you can take it, because these were clear agonist-antagonist groups, and what most endurance athletes, whether it's triathletes, runners, or cyclists, would train would be probably a more lower body dominant strength program with few, if any, upper body exercises. So how you then combine those things would be quite interesting. But I think, and I talked about this on a recent episode, that at least maybe it was in the Q&A, or maybe it's in next week's episode, I can't even remember. But how I prescribe strength training is not so much based on fitting in 4 heavy lifts in a session, or 5 even, but being happy with 2. And then the rest is more based around maybe probably 1 or 2 plyometric exercises, and then some specific weaknesses or improvement areas for the athlete, so often injury prevention. And basically then, I think it's easy to superset, for example, one of the heavier lifts with a core exercise or some kind of supplemental strength exercise. Might be some crab walks or side planks or whatever it might be. Those sorts of things that work more on that individual limiter, anti-tib races. All depends what sort of things an athlete has a history of. But that's an easy way to do a superset, and you still get that sort of recovery time, even though it's not direct sort of agonist-antagonist muscles. But if you want, at some point, if you want to just keep squeezing down the session to be shorter and shorter, can you, for example, superset a squat and a deadlift, or let's say a leg press and a leg curl? Can you superset those? That would be interesting to know.
Yeah, I think that would be quite a challenging combination. But I think the idea there is certainly interesting. I think that another study that I've seen in the past was relating a sort of rest pause protocol. So instead of doing 3x6 repetitions of a particular exercise with a consistent break in between, the athletes would do as many as they could repetitions, and then have a pause of 20 seconds when they had to stop. And then keep following that process until they got to 18 reps. So they were still doing 18, the similar as the 3x6. And they were able to have the same adaptation. So there's certainly different ways that you can optimize strength training. And I think that having these tools in your toolbox as an athlete who's not primarily focused on strength training is a good way to cut down on the time in the gym and still find a way to fit in strength training. You don't have to do supersets for all of the exercises as you're doing. So if you have just a few core exercises, like Michael was saying, but a few other sort of key exercises, and you superset a few of them, and then do some others the traditional way, you still could save a little bit of time in the gym. And that's a good way to optimize your training and still fits in the strength training, which lots of athletes skip if they are worried about time.
I love that lift, pause, lift study. That's actually fits in very nicely with, this was last week's episode, the Q&A I did with Jack, when one of the questions was about the timing zone. So whether it matters how you structure your intervals if you achieve the same timing zone. And this is basically lifts at a certain load for strength training. So the same concept, but I'll try the strength training. And in that case, it seemed to be equally effective with a different, very different distribution. Although it doesn't say that it would be the same if you just did one lift and then you rested for 5 minutes and then you did the second one and then you went on for 90 more minutes to to get your 18 lifts. But it's a cool study, so I like that. Yeah, do you have anything else on that one? I don't really, I would just, yeah, just practically, I would absolutely recommend trying to, if you, especially if you find that your strength sessions take too long, then if you're not already doing supersets, then then definitely implement them. And I think that's something that is easily done. And I think you can do it effectively without losing any of the benefits of the session. And this was a good study to kind of show that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an easy, simple, practical takeaway. The only thing that might be challenging is if you're in a commercial gym and you're trying to set up the superset somewhere. But I think people can still make that work. So it's a simple, practical study that everyone can use.
Yeah. Now I have my own home gym, but when I went to a commercial gym, I remember I was always very opportunistic with these things. So, you know, maybe what I'm doing squats, but then when I finish a squat, I see that, the elastic bands were there available. So I'll go and do something that I'm doing with my elastic bands. And then maybe somebody took those bands because I don't want to kind of hoard things while I'm doing my squats, but I'm going back and doing my squats. And then something else is available. Maybe it's a seated calf raise machine, or something else. So being quite opportunistic and looking at what's available and cross-referencing to my list. I'm not saying that it's the best and most efficient way of doing things because it got a bit scattergunned at times, but it was a good way to get things done in a short amount of time. And I think that for the main lifts, whether that be squats or deadlifts or so on, I think it allows you to still do them with the same quality that you would have if you just sat down and rested.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the key that the study is showing us, is that you can still get the same benefits. So you might have been trying that in the gym and worrying that it's affecting the quality of your work, but it's not. So that's a useful outcome for
me. Yeah, exactly. Now my confidence alone, I'm going to get more gains now.
Fantastic.
Okay, well, that's a good place to wrap up for today. Remember to check out the show notes for this episode where at scientificdriathlon.com, where I'll put all the links to the studies that we discussed and to our previous episode as well. Also, check the show notes or the episode description in your podcast app for our show sponsors. You can find the codes to Ruvi, Effortless Swimming, and Precision Full Hydration and their respective discount codes. If you're preparing for a race or you've had one that didn't go the way you hoped and you want to do better in your next one, or you just generally look to improve your endurance performance, remember that at Scientific Triathlon, we offer coaching, consultations, customized training plans, and ready-made training plans. And we've helped many thousands of athletes already across these categories to improve their endurance over the last almost 10 years, I think. So check that out. Check out scientificdriathlon.com if you're interested in our help, and get in touch if you want to learn more. And remember to visit Daniel's Substack called Endurance Ideas and Implementation, which of course will be linked to in the show notes as well. Daniel covers recent training and physiology research for endurance athletes. So if you like this kind of episode, then that's the place to go on a weekly basis to get more content and get it in a written format. And Daniel, you also said that you've done some updates to your website. So do you want to speak about that?
Yep, just updated some of the work that I've got explaining what I do as a coach. So if anyone is interested in coaching and interested in coaching with a research-based, evidence-based approach, they can check that out. It's danielrodencoaching.com.
Great. And I'll put the link to that as well in the show notes. And also, I want to mention just a bit of housekeeping about the podcast schedule. So the aim going forward, at least for the foreseeable future, is to do these research roundups on a monthly basis. And that will be the second episode of each month. And then we will also have Q&A episodes on a month. Will it be the second or the first? I need to check my schedule, but it will be on a monthly basis on the same, either the first or the second episode each month. And I suddenly got unsure about which one it will be, but I have that written down somewhere. And I'll also be doing Q&A episodes as the final episode of every month, also with the co-host usually. So there will be some recurring formats. So hopefully these are formats that a lot of listeners have written in and said that you enjoy them a lot. So I want to make them recurring, and also that way hopefully get even better at them, get them to be more useful, more educational, and just give them a proper chance to be mainstays of the rotation on the podcast. But of course, between that, we have plenty of opportunities for the classic interview formats or deep diving into specific topics like we have been doing. So that still stays. There's nothing that goes away, but it's just making a bit more of a recurring schedule for the research roundups and the Q&As. So yeah, let me know if you have feedback about that. I'd love to hear it. Also, one final thing, I already mentioned the sponsors, but I do want to say that Effortless Swimming are now available in Europe. So if you have been struggling with the shipping and the customs and everything, and you're in Europe, now that's no longer the case. So go to shop.effortlessswimming.com. They're available there. And remember to use the discount code that you can find in the episode description and in the show notes. That's it for today. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.